Welcome to Cardiothoracic Imaging, a podcast that explores the legends, legacies, and lessons of chest and cardiac imaging. I am Bert Dreher, Chairman of the Department of Diagnostic, Molecular, and Interventional Radiology at the Mount Sinai Medical Center and the Icahn School of Medicine, as well as a past president of the Radiologic Society of North America. I cordially invite you to sit back and relax as we journey through chest and cardiac imaging through the lens of the field's leading experts. And now, from the Mount Sinai Hospital in New York City, New York, it is my pleasure to introduce your hosts, Adam Bernheim and Michael Chung.
Welcome to Cardiothoracic Imaging. I am Adam Bernheim. I'm joined, as always, by Mike Chung. Mike, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. I'm actually very excited about our topic of conversation today. We have a radiologist who specializes in a lot of interventional procedures, so I think we'll have a lot of good questions, good answers, and good conversation today.
That's right. We're privileged to be joined by Dr. Feridun Abdin from UCLA. He is a thoracic interventional radiologist specializing in thoracic oncologic intervention. He's internationally known as an expert in minimally invasive treatment of lung cancer, mesothelioma, and thymoma. A prolific researcher, he has developed a variety of new and innovative treatments for these diseases and is currently the principal investigator on multiple clinical trials in this field. Dr. Abdin is especially well-versed in lung biopsy and thermal ablation of primary and metastatic pulmonary tumors. He practices radiofrequency ablation, microwave ablation, and cryoablation of thoracic tumors. In particular, he has pioneered the use of cryoablation in the treatment of pulmonary cancers. Dr. Abdin is the director of the Thoracic Imaging Research Laboratory and the director of the Santa Monica Outpatient Center. In this capacity, he has grown a robust lung biopsy practice and tissue biobank. Dr. Abdin completed his medical school at the Kasturba Medical College and continued on and completed his internship and radiology residency at the Kasturba Medical College as well. He then went on to complete a fellowship in thoracic radiology at UCLA and is a staff member and full professor at UCLA now. Dr. Abdin, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Adam and Mike, for hosting this podcast and inviting me to your program. And also thank you for all the listeners for, I guess, tuning into this podcast. And I hope I can share my experience with your audience.
Hi, Dr. Abdin. It's Mike here. Could you tell us a little bit about your background, where you're from, how you got into medicine and radiology, and what ultimately drew you to thoracic imaging?
Sure. I hope we have enough time. But I was born in Iran, and during early years of my life, I moved to India. I was 13 years old and sort of grew up there. I got into medicine and completed my medicine by 1995. When I graduated, I had this eager urge to be a surgeon. So I found a program and started joined the hospital to do surgery. And I was in charge of sort of a small hospital back in India. And I did 2 years of surgery. And back there, I sort of used to develop my own radiographs in, you won't believe it, in a small dark room with a couple of buckets of developer and fixer. If anybody, wow. I don't think anybody remembers or knows what those are, but if you spilled that on your shirt, that was it. You would have had a stain for the rest of your life. Back then, I realized like how much imaging was so important. Like you read about it and you do things in your residency, but only when you practice, you realize that without it, you were like really paralyzed. And so that kind of got me more and more interested in imaging. And that's how I decided at the end of 2 years that I don't want to pursue surgery anymore. And I want to get into radiology. When I joined my residency in 1997, that was when like some of the books by Dr. Webb and so on and so forth were coming out on HRCT. And that was quite interesting to me because here we were using CT scans to recollect that HRCT back then was one skip 10 in one breath hold, which would be like 40 seconds or so. We were able to basically detect different patterns on a CT scan. And that kind of got me interested quite a bit in chest. And once I graduated, somehow find my path to US, I come to UCLA. And there I met Dr. Golden and Dr. Abley, who were part of UCLA Thoracic Radiology. And kind of I got involved with quantitative imaging and joined a fellowship program under them. And since then, they've been my mentor and have sort of shaped, to some extent, a large part of my practice.
That's terrific. Could you tell us a little bit about cardiothoracic imaging at UCLA and what the section is like? For example, how many staff are in your section and what are typical volumes and case mixes?
Sure. Our practice here is the sections are actually separate. We have a separate cardiac section and we have a separate thoracic section. Both sections basically have overlapping staff, but some of us are like dedicated thoracic, with some of us have overlapping appointments with, for example, IR. For example, in cardiac section, we have 7 staff. 3 of them have joint appointment with chest, and 2 of them have joint appointments with IR. So they do more of vascular imaging as well as vascular IR procedures. With the thoracic section, it's 9 of us. 2 of the staff, myself and Dr. Sue, are both thoracic and IR. We have 2 staff which have oncology appointment, and 3 of our staff have DCVI. So, you know, although we have 2 sections, there's a lot of like overlap and mixed appointments. And based on the day, we are like scheduled in one or the other practice. As for our volume, UCLA per se is growing significantly in Southern California, and especially in LA. The radiology is growing with them. We are currently 8 outpatient centers which have imaging, either CT, MR, ultrasound, or X-ray, and or all. Our volume is growing significantly too. We have approximately 450 chest X-rays a day and 80 CT scans. And this is 7 days a week. It really doesn't slow down because our scanners, outpatient scanners, are continuously working. And inpatient just covers a limited number of our cases. As for cardiac, we have around 50 cases a day, a mixture of CT and MR, not many X-rays there. So that's most of our cardiothoracic practice. And of course, there's an IR component associated with it. We do approximately 4 to 5 lung biopsies a day and 1 ablation a day. And we have multiple centers. So if you average it out over a week, that's our volume.
Would you like to tell us a little bit about the fellowship opportunities at UCLA?
Sure. So a few years back, they gave me the opportunity to be in charge of the fellowship program. As you can see from the diversity of our group, we have thoracic staff which are interested in cardiac. We have thoracic staff which are interested in oncology. And we have thoracic staff which are interested in IR. I realized the fellowship also should be arranged such that sort of caters to the need of the fellows. In the past, we had a fellowship which the fellow would train or spend quite a bit of time on IR, and they would graduate, and then they did not receive enough cardiac training, or vice versa. They would graduate with IR and thoracic, and they wanted to be doing some more of oncology. So what I've done is, at UCLA, we have 12 months. I've divided it into 3 tracks. So in the beginning, the fellows can decide whether they want to go to a thoracic IR track, which is focuses on thoracic, diagnostic thoracic, and IR, thoracic IR interventions. And that would include 60-40%. So 3 days a week, they do diagnostic. 2 days, they do thoracic IR. Or they can do thoracic oncology, which is 60-40 between thoracic and abdominal imaging. There, they don't do much of IR. They can see or touch around, but really they don't get delved into depths of it. And we also have a cardiothoracic, which is 60% thoracic and 40% IR program. That's usually a breakup. I do allow the fellows to sort of like, if they change their mind from one track to go to another, but usually that doesn't happen. I try to be clear in the beginning. so that they can build their experience. But somehow the jobs they get, because that's one of the important things I want to provide to our fellows, is that the job they get requires them to do more of oncology. And that last few months of a year, we try to adjust such that, you know, they sort of cater to their future practice.
I think that's great that, yeah, it's very much catered so that it benefits each fellow, depending on where they're going to be, what kind of situation or what kind of environment they're going to be working in. Dr. Apton, could you also tell us about a little bit more about UCLA's Thoracic Interventional Service? You told us a little bit about the volumes that you have, but what are the types of procedures that you perform there?
Okay. We are part of thoracic section, but part of IR. But as IR or thoracic IR, we don't do majority of cases, and also we have to have like diagnostic coverage for the rest of the section. So we can provide 5 days a week IR service. So what we've divided, what we have done is myself and my partners, which is Dr. Su and Dr. Genshaf, we have divided the cohort of cases which come in into different categories. We call them tier system. And this is based on the complexity or how a case is referred to you. For example, you have a referring physician who just wants you to do a particular procedure for whatever the reason. But overall, as cases come in, we go through all the cases and we sort of separate them out into different sort of tiers. And if the cases are more complex or difficult, one of us takes it. And if the case is a little bit more simpler, like based on size and location, then it goes to the general pool of IR and we let them sort of take care of it. So that's how sort of our program is basically defined. Most of the cases we do are lung biopsies, either for primary diagnosis or for research. I would say a lot of them are for research. We also do intratumoral injections. That's something which is catching up quite a bit in the past few months, I would say. And there are multiple trials coming in for intratumoral injections. We also do lung ablations. The lung ablation is a little bit more referral-based, but if one is busy, the cases, as fresh cases come, we pass it on to our other colleagues to make sure the cases get done in a sort of a more timely fashion. But right now, it's three of us plus maybe one or two other IR attendees who are interested in doing this sort of ablations.
You mentioned intratumoral injections. Could you explain to the listeners a little bit about what types of lesions you're targeting and what exactly you inject into them?
Yeah, as you know, and I think as all the audience knows, that immunotherapy is taking a center stage in oncology treatment. And there's a lot of movement on treating this cancer, especially advanced cancer, with immunotherapy. Unfortunately, immunotherapy doesn't work for everyone. And if you look at even the Keynote trial, response rates were 20% or so. And also, after a certain amount of response, these patients develop an element of resistance to the drug or develop complications, and these treatments have to be stopped. So what's going on mostly is that a lot of immune checkpoint inhibitors or immune modulators are being modified or they're being used synergistically with stimulators so that their initial effect can be magnified. This can be in different forms, either in a form of stimulating the immune system so that when you are giving checkpoint inhibitors, the immune system is stimulated and the response is exaggerated. For example, they inject diphtheria bacillus, kill diphtheria bacillus, or some other sort of virus antigen just to stimulate the body so there's increased immunity. And then when they introduce the checkpoint inhibitors, that immunity has an exaggerated effect against tumors. And that's one of the sort of injections we do. There's also injection of dendritic cells. So this blood is basically separated out, and then we inject that into the tumor so that the dendritic cells have a direct sort of antigenic response to the tumors where these cells develop antigen directly at the level of the tumor itself. There's also trials with CTL4. There's trials with injection of TC receptor inhibitors, which is another pathway of immune inhibition and release of antigens. So a lot of it is frankly speaking, I'm learning as I'm going too. These are all new to me. I definitely didn't know about many of these when I finished my medicine or residency. But, you know, it's something for our listeners to keep in mind. I myself educate myself every time I go to a tumor board and kind of try to learn a couple of new ideas from our oncologists. And that's how I educate myself.
It's really fascinating stuff. But I guess going back to even in your earlier career, you might not have been able to imagine that you'd be doing things like this today. How did you develop that initial interest or that passion for thoracic oncologic intervention? Did you have any early mentors that really were influential during your early career trajectory?
It's hard to say when does it all start. I think it's all building blocks, which sort of creates you to kind of join a path or move forward in a path. Those blocks could be areas where you're interested on, and sometimes good mentors and opportunities. I think they all kind of go to some extent hand in hand. I never thought I would be a thoracic interventional radiologist to start with. I think in the beginning, when I was doing my residency, I was very impressed with one of my attendings. His name was Dr. Mehta. Back in like 1997, I was really impressed the way sort of IR and vascular IR was performed and sort of helped in diagnosis. And again, back in those days, it was mostly diagnosis, not much of therapeutic. So IR really stayed in the back of my mind. Thoracic, of course, I was always interested in diagnostic. And when I joined UCLA, I was very fortunate because the program here provided a combination of both diagnostic and IR. And that was perfect. You know, I like kind of grew into it. I was fortunate to have met Dr. Sue, who is really a pioneer in thoracic IR. And during those 2 years of my fellowship, I kind of like really grew into that. So that's how I grew interest to IR and later on to thoracic IR. And that sort of helped to build my career. But then opportunities came. As you pointed out, back in 2004, there was nothing like interventional oncology per se. We were doing biopsies, but there was no intratumoral injection. Ablation was just introduced, you know, the first three cases were published in 2000. So it was not something, we didn't have any machine. We had these old RF machines. We did a handful of cases a year. And so over the course of time, both the interest and opportunities kind of grew together. And that, to some extent, helped shape my career.
Dr. Apton, I just want you to reflect back. I guess you've done maybe thousands of procedures at this point. Could you share any fun stories for the listeners out there or any kind of very difficult cases that you might have encountered? Anything that really maybe shaped you to be who you are today?
I can say that I still sweat during every case. There's not a case which I'm not concerned about. But
even the lowest tier ones?
Even the... You do them enough, you know that even the lowest tier ones can sometimes end up in complications. And you got to be just prepared for the case and don't take things lightly. But one of the cases which actually built my career was back in 2005. I was just walking in a corridor in DIR and I get one of our nursing staffs, like there's a patient online who's called us from England, and she has a question. So I pick up the phone. I'm like, okay, how can I help you? And she's like, you know, I got mesothelioma. I have a primary mesothelioma. And I know that the treatment for mesothelioma is surgery. But the National Institute of Health in England does not allow surgery if the tumor extended beyond the chest wall. And she said, I have a focal spot which extends beyond chest wall. And based on that, they cannot perform the surgery. She said, is there anything you can do? Back then, I had just done maybe 3 or 4 cryoablation. It had just come into the market. We were just dealing, understanding how the system works. So I told her, you know what, I'll call you back. I really don't know much. So I go and speak to one of our thoracic surgeons. It's funny. I walk down and I see a thoracic surgeon in the cafeteria. I walk up to him and say, you know, I have this case. What do you think? And he was very forthcoming. He said, you know what, definitely not come to US. The cost is going to kill them. But speak to John Edwards in England and see if he'll do it. So anyway, I get in touch with him and I ask him, will you do it? He said, if you show that there's no tumor, outside the pleural, then I'll go ahead and do it. So coordinate, bring the patient here. I do a chest wall cryoablation and destroy the tumor, which was extending out. On a PET scan, it was negative. She undergoes surgery. She survived for a long time before she developed recurrence of tumor and metastasis. And unfortunately, she couldn't keep on coming back and forth to get the cryos done. But she survived almost 5 years after that procedure. So that really always remained in my mind. It was like, you know, you just don't give up. She didn't give up. We didn't give up. And we managed to sort of work out something out of a box, which kind of led to one of some of the practices I have here.
If when you look up your name and in just the literature, you've published so much on just cryoablation for mesothelioma. So that's really where it started in 2005, huh?
Absolutely, yeah. And that was it. And we kind of like replicated that to some extent in both recurrent mesothelioma, later on with recurrent thymoma, and then for bone ablation. We've done a significant amount of metastatic bone ablation. We were part of a MOTION trial here at UCLA as well. That sort of helped build a better understanding of cryo, not only for myself, my colleagues learned from it. And like we've tried to teach that across the United States to our other colleagues, yeah.
Since we're going to be talking about the different types of ablation in this discussion, maybe just for some basic introduction, could you start us off by sharing with our listeners who may not be that well-versed in the advantages and disadvantages of the different ablation types, RF ablation, microwave ablation, and cryoablation? Can you just give us a brief primer on how you think about which ablation technique to utilize when evaluating a potential case?
Sure. So when you look at those three ablations, RFA, microwave, and cryo, you can put RFA and microwave in one category. These are electrical-based and heat-based ablations, so you heat up the system. And cryo basically creates an ice, so it's a completely different type of an ablation. And when you look at them, RFA and microwave behave very similar. There are certain differences between them, and I think RFA slowly is becoming less and less mainstream. It's kind of like falling off charts simply because microwave is a better system. It's an easier system to use. So anyway, everyone who's got an RFA is slowly migrating to microwave. For comparison, I give this example. Let's say you have a chicken. For the sake of it, it's like a nicely plucked chicken, fresh. You take that and put it in a freezer, and you take another one and put it on a grill, like a hot grill. After, I would say, 3 hours, if you look at the chicken in the freezer, it's sort of, it looks like a chicken, it's just frozen. But the one in the oven most likely is burned after 3 hours. And to me, cryo and microwave follows basically the same principle. Microwave is a heat-based system, so it destroys tissue by heating it up and charring it. You receive like a destruction of tissue very locally. It's actually pretty quick. It destroys tissue quite fast. Cryo kills cells, but it really doesn't destroy tissue. Multiple papers have shown that it really the structure, especially the fibrinous structure, non-cellular structure of tissue remains intact. So you can actually use cryo very close to certain structures like bronchus or sometimes certain vessels or even periphery of a lung. When you use that, it doesn't cause like a destruction where you can get with microwave. So keeping that analogy in mind, and you know, with heat, you get more inflammation, more burn compared to ice. So keeping all that in mind and the way sort of a heat propagates in lung, I like to use cryo in mostly periphery of the lung, where the ice ball can extend either in the pleura or can sort of the ice can migrate back along the shaft into the pleura, or if the ice can grow into the chest wall or into the mediastinum. So when you use the cryo in that region, although the ice ball can damage tissue, but you don't develop sort of a destruction of that area and you don't get communication between various tissue. For example, if you use microwave in the periphery of a lung, there's high chance of like fistulization, I would say sloughing of the lung. So I tried not to use microwave in the periphery. I use cryo in the periphery. And for central lesions, by central, I mean medial two-third of a lung, I prefer using microwave because then the heat which is generated is kept within the lung. the lung behaves like an oven, doesn't allow that heat to extend, and make sure that sort of that heat doesn't destroy surrounding structures like a rib cage, especially pleura, chest wall, muscle, and so on and so forth. So that's how I kind of overall divide where to use what. There are other things like cryo is associated with bleeding. So if the patient's got bleeding disorders or is cirrhotic patients or severe emphysema, then I like to use microwave compared to cryo. If the tumor is too large, then you want to use cryo because microwave can like destroy significant amount of tissue. So I think those are some of the nuances you want to keep in mind while using them. Mm-hmm. A few years back, I worked with Dr. Sharma and Dr. Shepherd on an RCNA article, and there we made a table, which I've modified it over the course of years, but it was at RCNA 2012, and you know, if you look at that table, it kind of gives you an idea about where to use what modality.
At least from a timing standpoint, which of the techniques will be faster or the more efficient procedures?
I think microwave is by far faster. The needles are sharper. The setup is faster. So like testing it is much faster. It's just like maybe 5 seconds to test it. The machine is lighter. So you can actually perform a microwave as fast as a biopsy. It's just that because some of the side effects it can have, then the management becomes difficult if you have to deal with the bronchopleural fistula and so on and so forth. So. Mm-hmm. But cryo takes a long time to set up. The probes are a little harder to manipulate, puncturing structures. The ice ball which is formed is limited. So cryoablation is technically more challenging. Mm-hmm.
Just in general, when it comes to interventional procedures, I feel like the safety and the efficacy is really dependent a lot of times on the radiologist's skill. Does the same apply for these three techniques? Is there a bit of a learning curve for each of them, or is it almost foolproof?
No, absolutely. I think there's a learning curve. I think we are pushing the boundaries as we learn more and more about these techniques and learn from our mistakes. For the listeners who are starting, I think best thing to do when it comes to lung procedures, start with lung biopsies, kind of like sort of that needle handling and understanding of the lung. And then move on to performing ablations, I would say starting with like a more of a easier cases, sub 3 centimeters nodules in the lung, not too close to the hilar structures, and sort of build praxis. I think the learning curve is very steep for people who've done multiple lung biopsies. Mm-hmm. Very quickly they learn. I think a course here and there, either through various societies, will really help them build their confidence and sort of start doing these procedures.
I guess the cases that you're doing for RFA, microwave, or cryo, are these all patients that have been discussed in a multidisciplinary tumor board, or are you even getting your own consults just as a separate part of your interventional service?
Great question. Majority of my cases are not through multidisciplinary clinics. Mm. I am always present in multidisciplinary clinics and sort of advocate for ablation. But most of our multidisciplinary clinic, which is as a part of a thoracic, is lung cancer. Most of those cases go for surgery. And if the patient is not a surgical candidate, then either come to radiation or ablation. What I've managed, at least in our multidisciplinary thoracic oncology practice, make sure that the surgeons and the oncologists understand that survival outcome and local control of a disease is similar between ablation and SBRT. It's mm-hmm. taken me a very long time, but we've been fortunate in the past couple of years with a bunch of data coming out that I'm able to provide that information. We are still lagging behind compared to radiation, but we are catching up. The data is slowly coming out on those grounds. Majority of my cases actually come from direct referral. It's majority of them are physicians who've been present in the tumor board to kind of see and observe. Sometimes you got to do show and tell a little bit. You know, you've done a good case. If the patient is well controlled, you show it to the tumor board and say, you know what, this patient was referred to me. I did the ablation. There's no local recurrence. Is there room for chemotherapy? You know, they look at it and say yes or no. Mm-hmm. So I think it's important to sometimes, you know, be it ablation, be it something else you've done. There are still surgeons in my hospital don't know what are we capable of. So we have to keep on reminding them what we can do. But those surgeons or those oncologists who are present in the tumor board very often send me cases not through the tumor board, but they say, you know what, I have this patient, I've done one lobectomy, there's a new recurrence, would you be able to do the ablation on it? So what's important is we have to take the discussion to the surgeons and oncologists that when they see the patient, they should offer ablation to the patient. Or the other way around, as a group, as a society, we should push the patients to be aware and ask their oncologists or surgeons, how about ablation? What are those? What are my options with that?
Sure. I think you mentioned it kind of indirectly, but some of the best advice for someone, I would think, looking to start an ablation service in their own hospital would be to just be really present in their multidisciplinary conferences and just to make your face known. I think that's great advice.
Absolutely, yeah. And, you know, there are turfs. People are, to some extent, protective. And I think the best way is just as IR, you know, we provide kind of a service which is sometimes life-saving to the patients, and others can provide from the chest tubes you have to place to embolizations. And so you get recognized with your surgeon, your oncologist, whenever you get an opportunity, get to know them better. And then just talk about what you're able to do, and slowly cases start coming to you, you know. And don't jump onto cases which are very complex in the beginning. And if you have to, just reach out to someone else who's done these more and discuss the cases. I think there's a whole lot of us around who are more than happy to discuss cases and say what could be the approach. I myself still reach out to my colleagues and say, hey, what do you think about this? What should I do? And you'll be surprised how others think, and you know, people think very different. You know, you learn so much from others. So that's one way to go. Yeah.
Dr. Apton, you mentioned in passing the role of radiation, and I think that there's a general trend nationally that SBRT, stereotactic body radiation therapy, is increasing over the last several years. I'm just kind of curious, could you compare and contrast CT-guided ablation with SBRT for treatment of primary neoplastic and metastatic disease in the chest? In other words, when do you think it's most appropriate to consider one of the ablation techniques as opposed to SBRT?
That's a great question. I'll try to answer it, I would say, in the least biased way. And that would be all cases should go for ablation.
Okay.
All right. Let me explain this further out. In 2018, two papers came out. They both looked at a national cancer database, and the both cohorts showed the same thing. Patients with stage one lung cancer who were treated with RFA and SBRT, they both had same overall survival over the course of years. So when it comes to survival outcome, you see that both these procedures almost perform the same. So that is something to keep in mind. And so that data is currently out there. What you see from that is, again, ablation has remained very limited. We cover at most 1% to around 3%, depending on which time point of these patients. Majority of these patients go to SBRT. And I think one of the reasons is we have done a very bad job of organizing multi-center trials to look at outcome of ablation, prospective trials. We have only probably one or two of them. That's one thing. Second thing is we've not incorporated ourselves with both NCCN or NIH. If you look at the data, if you look at their website, you see that ablation either is mentioned in the passing or not even mentioned. So for patients or for practitioners outside some of these larger institutes, there is no guidelines for them to send a patient for ablation, or patients don't even know about it. How can they even ask for it? So basically, overall outcome, you see that SBRT and ablation almost perform the same. I think what I suggest to my patients is that if you're not a surgical candidate, be it you've had surgery before, you have multiple primary lung carcinomas, and with lung cancer screening, we are picking up these more and more, these multiple part solid nodules, you have a small ground glass nodule, which is slowly evolving itself into early stage lung cancer, be it MIA or minimally invasive adenocarcinoma or like AIS. So these patients are not surgical candidates, or surgery may be too aggressive for them. I always tell these patients, and I tell them, the choice is theirs, of course. But if we do an ablation, we are able to treat these tumors almost the same as SBRT, but we are able to do a much sharper surveillance. We don't damage the lung, and we don't have radiation changes in the lung, which becomes very difficult for us to differentiate from local recurrence or from radiation pneumonitis elsewhere. And so I tell the patients, get the ablation done, and we continue surveillance. If there's local recurrence, we can go ahead and re-ablate it. That is my suggestion to the patient. So where does SBRT stand? I think if the patient is not even an ablation candidate, or if ablation is risky, I think this patient should undergo SBRT to some extent. If the tumor is too central, then I think these patients require to undergo a combination of SBRT and ablation, because SBRT itself cannot work very well centrally. Or if the tumor is too big, I think when you hit tumors which are more than 3 centimeters in size, the role of ablation becomes to some extent limited, because you may not be able to cover that whole area with ablation. After all, our needles are straight and you are unable to get this sort of a convoluted shapes. So for sub 3 centimeter nodules, I always advocate ablation. And for larger tumors, I say you can undergo SBRT. So I think that's overall. And if patients are not a candidate for ablation at all, then of course undergo SBRT. But very rarely patients are not candidate for ablation and they are candidate for SBRT. You see, they also have the same shortcomings. You know, they will cause complications from pneumonitis. And you know, a lot of these patients cannot withstand that. So those are basically my sort of differentiation. But ultimately, the choice lies now with the patient. And, you know, I live in Los Angeles, and in Los Angeles, we have a serious traffic issue. And my patients rather come once in a hospital, get the ablation done. If they have to stay, 10% of patients stay overnight and go home, rather than come multiple times to the hospital and pay $60 for parking so and withstand the traffic. So to me, a lot of my patients complain about that.
Yeah, thank God for the LA traffic. I think that that's maybe the only time anyone's ever said that. Dr. Apton, so what do you think the role will be going forward for RF ablation, microwave ablation, and cryoablation just in the chest, the overall role in the spectrum of medical care? And are there any new exciting technical innovations in the field of thoracic oncologic intervention that have you particularly excited?
I think, as you mentioned, and I think I didn't touch base upon, is that role of ablation for treatment of metastases or oligometastatic disease is becoming more and more defined. Both microwave and cryo, again, are used for patients who've had treatment with systemic therapy and they either have skip lesions or they want to have like drug holiday for the patients, where the patient takes a break from one systemic therapy and goes on to another. Again, ablation plays a major role there. I would say transition between one treatment to another. So I think there we play a role. I think another area where you see both current techniques is combination therapy, where you use either cryo or microwave to stimulate the immune system. And I feel that's coming to fruition now, and you'll see more and more of those combination treatments coming up, where we stimulate the immune system by releasing the antigens through cryo or microwave, the so-called Skopal effect, and allow the immune system to fight the tumors or residual tumors. Where I see these modalities and newer modalities, I think there'll be more and more advancement in these technologies. We've definitely seen that since 2000. Like, we've just been 20 years into its production. I think you'll see more sort of a specific tunable microwaves. You'll see a more robust cryo system where they don't use argon, use like tankless cryo systems. I think those are some of the modifications to our existing systems you'll see. I think IRE, which was electroporation or irreversible electroporation, I think that's going to come back. I think there are some new technologies. And IRE was perfect. It's just that it failed. It was difficult to sort of perform it in the lungs. But I think if it comes back, it'll be like a really limited injury to tissue sort of ablation. What we are doing is brachytherapy, where we place seeds. And I know this has been around. People left seeds behind, but we don't leave them behind. This is like focal treatment, especially like for central lesions. We do this brachytherapy. In the next few years, you'll see a big role of transbronchial ablation, where ablations are not done percutaneously and they're done transbronchially. There are multiple companies who are working with robotic systems who want to perform these transbronchial procedures. And the question comes then whether it's going to be done by IR or it's going to be done by interventional pulmonologists. I think that's something to figure out down the line. But I think that's going to be the next wave you'll hear of. Few years after that, I feel, and I foresee that, you'll start seeing more of vascular or catheter-directed treatment with drug-eluting hydrogels. I think those will be coming shortly as well, you know, where delivery of drug through the systemic circulation is through these gels rather than systemic injection, getting systemic toxicity. I think that would be the next step. You'll see that where IR will have a significant growth in chest. And not only in chest, by the way. I think it'll be for majority of tumors where there will be no systemic therapy. There'll be local injection of these systemic therapies. Doesn't make sense to expose the entire body to some of them, correct?
What particular career goals do you have for yourself over the course of the next decade?
10 years is a long time, but I feel thoracic IR overall hasn't received its worthy recognition. And I've been involved with various either patient groups like both mesothelioma and lung cancer consortium for patient education. I'm working with groups both in SIR and SIO for better incorporation of our ablation techniques in sort of the guidelines. So I hope that in the near future, I see myself sort of taking more and more active role in sort of trying to incorporate that in guidelines. I want to continue working on immuno-oncology and interventional oncology per se and better understand where these immune modulators, how they work with lung cancer. I see that as both time and educational challenge, but I'm working on it. So I hope that we'll be able to like sort of incorporate that better into management of lung cancer and even metastasis for our patients. So I hope that in the next, I would say, decade or so, I'll be able to sort of make heads or tail of this.
Thank you so much, Dr. Apton. We look forward to that next decade. Thank you so much for your time. We were extremely appreciative of it.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to Cardiothoracic Imaging, a podcast that journeys through the legends, legacies, and lessons of chest and cardiac imaging. We hope you have enjoyed listening and look forward to seeing you next time.